Jealous. Her baby sister. But mainly fascinated, as Bethan now possessed the only substantial pair of breasts in the family. Let me see, then, she badgered as Lorelei and Beth bustled into the house on a dry April afternoon halfway through the Easter holidays. Beth looked embarrassed as Meg snatched the bag from her. Oh, she said, fingering the cream lace thing with its solid underwiring and its unlikely capacious cups. Nice, she said, trying not to sound jealous. Did you get anything else? No, said Beth, snatching back the bra and shoving it into the carrier bag before one of her little brothers saw it. I did, though, said Lorelei, her high cheekbones flushed pink, her green eyes flashing with something chemical and profound. Look, there's a new shop opened in town. What was it called, Beth? Beth rolled her eyes and said, Pound Stretcher. Yes, Pound Stretcher. Everything's a pound. Can you imagine? Look. She emptied a bulging carrier bag onto the tabletop and let her eyes roam over her booty with a hunger and a joy that were almost tangible. Look, she said, hangers. 10 for a pound. Aren't they lovely? I just love the colours. Especially this blue one. And pan scourers. £1 for 20. Meg, too, stared at the items on the tabletop and said, Why have you bought 3 packs? Her mother's smile froze for a split second. Then she laughed and said, Always good to have stockpiles. Oh, yes, said Meg. Just think how smug we'll be when we're living in a post-apocalyptic wilderness and we're the only family in the village with pan scourers. Meg saw Beth's face cloud over then and noticed a tiny, barely perceptible shake of her head. She tutted loudly and said, 60 pan scourers, Beth. We have 60 pan scourers. Beth smiled apologetically and Lorelei stood there, her shoulders slightly slumped. The light gone from her eyes. Why do you always have to spoil everything, Meggie? Why? Her eyes filled with tears, and she hurriedly returned her treasures to the carrier before leaving the room. What? Snapped Meg, looking at Beth's accusing face. Oh, come on. Why do you have to be so hard on her? Don't you see? Meg hissed. It's because of you lot, everyone in this fucking family, that she is the way she is. You encourage her. But what does it matter, said Beth. Who cares if we've got too many pan scourers? Who cares if funny things make her happy? Why does it bother you so much? Because, she began, the rage starting to separate in her mind into manageable chunks of theory, because I think she's ill. Beth laughed, and then stopped dramatically. Ill? Yes, said Meg. Mentally. Ill in the head. Oh, don't be so ridiculous. I am not being ridiculous. I mean it. All this. All these collections and obsessions with colours and tea towels and rainbows. Beth shrugged. And think of what she was like when she was a child. You know, collecting hair. Everyone acts like that's normal. It's not normal, it's crazy. What are you two whispering about? Asked Rory, passing them in the hallway, his long blonde hair hanging into his eyes, long skinny legs like his dad's in baggy jeans, the best-looking boy in his class, apparently. Not that he was interested in what the girls in his class thought of him yet. He was only 12. Nothing, snapped Meg. You're talking about the pan scourers, aren't you? Meg said nothing. Beth said, Don't you start. I'm not starting anything, he said nonchalantly. I think it's great. Who could ever have too many pan scourers?
Where's Rhys?
Asked Beth, delicately changing the subject.
Outside, said Rory, staring.
The three children laughed at the predictability of this reply. Megan looked from Beth to Rory, her siblings, and, for their many differences, her soulmates. And then she thought of Rhys. Tiny, unknowable, inexplicable Rhys, lying in the garden, staring into empty blueness, all alone. She thought, for a moment, of going out to find him, to ask him what he was thinking about. But then the phone rang in the hall, and it was Andrew Smart wanting to take her to a gig on Saturday night, and no sooner had it arrived than the thought faded from her consciousness. Easter Sunday dawned warm and gold. Meg's eyes struggled to open against the dazzling morning sun. Her radio alarm told her it was only 8:29. She stopped struggling to open her eyes and let them fall closed again. As she waited for sleep to return, her thoughts reeled through the pleasing events of the previous night. The screech of tires on tarmac as Andrew Smart and his friend Nick pulled up outside the house to collect her. The metallic smell of vodka in a hip flask being passed back and forth between the three of them. The sun setting behind the tall trees as the countryside flashed past in a copper-hued blur. Andrew Smart's fingers absent-mindedly tickling the small of her neck. A wonderful, grown-up, easy sense of it being no big deal. The feeling of escape from the house and the village. The buzzing queue wrapped tantalizingly around the venue. The smell of congealed beer. The feel of strangers' clammy T-shirts against her bare skin. Andrew's arm across her shoulder. The music, the roll and swell of the mosh pit, and then the cool air on her flesh as they drove home again, too fast, down winding roads, spiky shadows of trees thrown across the road by the headlights, and then a quick kiss on the lips outside her house. Nothing more. It hadn't been a date, not in that sense. Nick had watched fondly from the back seat and said, "Oh, sweet." Andrew had thrown a rolled-up paper bag at him, and Meg had slipped from the car and into the dark of the sleeping house, light as air, smelling of other people's cigarette smoke, smiling. She'd jumped when she'd seen him sitting there. "Rhys! Shit, you scared the crap out of me! What are you doing up so late?" He was sitting at the kitchen table, in his pyjamas, his blonde hair lank around his face. His hands were spread open on the tabletop, bathed in a bluish light from the moon through the window. He shrugged.
"Couldn't sleep," he said.
Meg frowned.
"Couldn't you, you know, like, read a book or something?" she asked.
He shrugged and pulled his open hands into fists.
"Come on," she said. "I'm too wired to sleep. Come and watch some telly with me."
The living room was dark, apart from the embers in the fire basket. The remnants of her parents' evening were still strewn about the room. Two empty wine glasses, jar of olives, the mail, slippers and a cookbook held open at a recipe for chicken masala. The sofa still bore the imprints of both parents and the dog. No cushions had been plumped, no debris removed, as though they had faded away rather than actively gone to bed. It was the end of some film, an old-fashioned American thing with women with flicked hair and men in nonsensical flared trousers and a plinky-plonky soundtrack. Megan brought through a carton of orange juice and two beakers.
"Meggie?"
She heard her father's reedy voice emanate from somewhere above.
"Is that you?"
"Yes."
"Just checking." "Sleep tight, darling."
"You too, Dad." Meg and Rhys looked at each other and smiled. "How long had you been sitting there?" said Meg. Rhys shrugged again.
"Dunno."
"Do you do that often?"
"Not really."
"What were you thinking about?"
"Not much."
An American lady on the TV was shouting at an American man who was wearing aviator glasses and a gold necklace. They were standing underneath a palm tree. Usually Meg would have given up at this point. But her mind was soft with vodka and music and the first tentative outposts of falling in love. So she moved closer to her brother and stared at him thoughtfully and said,
you happy, Rhys?
He looked at her sideways.
Of course I am.
Is school all right?
Yes, fine.
She paused, then continued. It's just, you know, Rory seems to have made so many friends already, but you...
There's more to life than friends,
he snapped back.
Megan nodded.
Of course, she said. But is there anyone at school? Anyone who you hang out with? You know, at lunchtime and stuff?
Sure, he said. Loads of people.
Are people kind to you?
Rhys spun round and fixed her with a black look.
Let's just watch the film, shall we?
He said. I don't want to watch the film. I want to talk to you. I never talk to you.
Talking's overrated.
How can you say that?
He turned away from her then and rearranged himself on the sofa. Megan stared at him for a moment, the delicate set of his features, his sinewy arms hanging from a baggy grey T-shirt, his sharp kneecaps pushing through the denim of his unfashionable jeans. He seemed so angry, so sad. She sighed, and when the film finished 5 minutes later, she ran her hand gently over the crown of Rhys's head and made her way upstairs to bed without saying good night. When Megan finally arose, 2 hours after first waking up, she found her mother in the kitchen in rose-print pyjamas, her long hair twisted into a bun.
Oh, good, she beamed. You're up. Bob and Jenny are sending their little ones over in half an hour for an egg hunt. I need your help.
The gig was fantastic, thanks for asking, Meg replied. Andrew Smart kissed me on the lips and we've arranged to go out again on Thursday.
Her mother blinked at her in surprise.
Oh, she said vaguely. Good.
That's good, then?
Of course it's good. Not that I expect you to care when there's vitally important things like egg hunts to arrange.
Oh, Meggie. Her mother folded her arms together and pouted.
No one's saying it's vitally important. It's just... This is us. The birds. This is what we do. Easter Sunday, rain or shine. It's a tradition.
Yes, but Mum, your youngest children are now 12 years old. It's a tradition that needs to end.
Nonsense.
I mean, Bob and Jenny have got their own garden. Why can't they do their own egg hunt for their own children?
Her mother's eyes started to brim with tears.
Because, she said, we've better nooks and crannies in our garden. They're all laid to lawn next door. You know, very flat.
Megan nodded sagely.
Oh, yes, she said. Very flat, poor wee things.
So?
Her mother ignored the sarcasm and brightened herself.
I need to go up and dress myself. Can I leave you to open the packets?
Megan sighed.
Yes, sure.
Good, Lorelei beamed. Thank you, darling girl.
Bob and Jenny and their three children arrived at just after 11 a.m. Rory and Rhys agreed to join in with the little ones, and by 11:30 all the eggs had been found. Lorelei's eyes shone with a mixture of satisfaction and, Megan couldn't help but notice, a hint of panic as the children handed the eggs to their mother to save for after lunch.
Don't forget to save the foils, she trilled. All such lovely, lovely colours.
Megan tutted and said something mean about her mother under her breath, which thankfully she didn't hear.
Such a shame you can't stay for lunch, said Lorelei as their neighbours made their farewells half an hour later.
Yes, well, Bob's mother's over from Ireland, so it's a big clan reunion.
Pandora was in the Bahamas with Lawrence, and Lorna was in Devon with friends. For the first time in living memory, the Bird family were alone on Easter Sunday.
So, said Colin, closing his cutlery together and scrunching up his paper napkin after lunch. I've had an idea. Slightly crazy, but listen. How about next Easter, since it might well be the last Easter everyone's still at home, we go away somewhere? We haven't been away as a family since before the twins were born. There's some amazingly cheap package deals around these days. And I've always wanted to go to Greece. Megan could feel Lorelei's expression change without even looking at her. It was like an ice flow passing through the room, steady and foreboding. She laughed first, as Megan had suspected she might, a menacingly girlish sound. And then she said, "What a silly idea, Colin. How on earth could we afford to go away with four children?" "Well," said Colin, beginning rather nervously to stack together dirty plates, "I was thinking, with the girls growing up now, we don't really need the big car anymore. I mean, when was the last time all six of us went anywhere together?" "So we could sell it." "Oh, come on," snorted Lorelei. "Who on earth would buy our dirty, disgusting old car?" "We could sell it to the Millers," he continued patiently. "They're expecting their fourth child any day. They've offered 1,500 for it." "Ha!" said Lorelei. "More money than sense, those Millers. And then, if we've only got the one car, we won't need the double garage anymore. And I was just talking to Bob, and he said he'd buy the other half of our garage off us for 5 grand. Megan had not drawn breath for almost 30 seconds, watching this almost comically doomed conversation unfold. 5 grand! Ridiculous! "Well, yes, but he wants to build an extension at the back and use the garage as a workshop, so it's worth it for them." "But all our things! I mean, we have so much stuff stored in there." "Well, yes, indeed we do, like several burst paddling pools, my sweetheart. It's overdue a clear out." In the absence of anything logical to say, Lorelei merely flapped her bony hands about and said, "Oh, it's all just silly. And a package deal to Greece sounds quite ghastly." Colin smiled gently and turned his gaze to his four children. "Kids, what do you think? Easter in the sun? Calamari and chips for lunch? Swimming pools with slides? On-site disco?" He aimed this last at Megan and Bethan. Lorelei laughed again, that high-pitched schoolgirl thing she did. "Sounds like someone's been doing their homework." "Just some brochures," said Colin, "from the agents on the high road. Want to have a look?" He smiled and glanced at each child in turn. "Oh, Colin, honestly," said Lorelei, piling up the plates from her side of the table. "This really is about the silliest plan I've heard. And even if we can afford it. And who's to say that the Millers and Bob won't change their minds, leaving us with a stonking great unpaid debt to some tacky holiday company? If it's going to be our last Easter altogether, then it has to be here. At the birdhouse. Isn't that right, kiddos?" A terrible silence fell upon the table. Rory cast his gaze down to his lap. Bethan nibbled her fingernails, and Rhys stared at the ceiling. Megan looked intently through the kitchen window at a magpie bouncing on the branches of a tree outside, and tried not to read too much symbolism into its presence at this precise moment. "I'd like to go away," said Megan, taking the lead as the firstborn child. "I mean, I know we'll always be able to come back here as the years go by, but once I leave home, who knows if we'll ever get the chance to go on holiday together again." She shrugged and left her words hanging. There was a small shard of silence, during which Colin nodded encouragingly, and Lorelei raised her eyebrows exasperatedly. "What about you?" he asked Beth. She smiled apologetically and said, "I want to do whatever everyone else wants to do."
"Rory?"
"Cool," said Rory. "Yeah, brilliant." Then he looked slightly embarrassed by his betrayal and turned away. Reese?
Reese blushed and shrugged.
Don't mind, he said almost silently.
Well, there you go, said Lorelei triumphantly, holding the pile of plates out in front of herself. Looks like nobody's particularly interested. And I'm sure we can think of better things to spend all that money on. I mean, Meggie will be off to college next September. That'll be an expensive enterprise.
Colin frowned and said, You know my mother's offered to help us out with all that, so that's not an issue, darling.
Well, she said, landing the pile of plates into the butler's sink with a deafening clatter, I still don't see the point of spending all that money on a holiday that nobody's really interested in.
Meg stared at the shape of her mother, rigid and too thin at the kitchen sink, her shoulder blades protruding through the chambray cotton of her smocked tunic, and she swallowed the urge to walk over to her and hit her with her cutlery hard around the back of the head. Instead, she inhaled and said, I think I recall saying that I wanted to go, Mother.
And me, said Rory.
Lorelei's shoulders slumped and she sighed. And then, very slowly and deliberately, she left the kitchen, sobbing quietly under her breath. On the 25th of July that same year, while Lorelei was out at the shops and Megan was violently kissing Andrew Smart on a blanket in a field in the middle of nowhere, and the twins and Bethan were alone in the house, 2 16-year-old boys wearing hooded jackets broke in and took, after a leisurely exploration, the video player, 2 television sets, a watch, some jewellery, and a leg of lamb and a joint of beef from the chest freezer in the utility room. They did all of this without disturbing any of the 3 children in the house. And it was only when they let the kitchen door bang shut behind them that Reese peered over his window ledge just in time to see them running down the garden path and onto the street. He rushed then to a window overlooking the street and saw them pile into a matte black Ford Escort and screech away through the village, whooping and hollering through the opened windows as though they thought they were in Harlem. Reese found the whole episode thrilling beyond words. He called 999 before he even told the others for fear that someone else would want to do it. And for a few days afterwards, he dined out on the whole episode, to the point of being boring. But Lorelei couldn't see the harmless drama of the thing. She could only see it as, in her own melodramatic words, a violation akin to rape. She kept stalking desolately round the house, peering into corners and touching things. And at the merest sound of footsteps on the pavement outside the window, or the whine of a car driving too fast, or the rumble of a car driving too slow, or the crack of a twig under the paws of a squirrel, or the rustle of leaves in a soft breeze, Lorelei would gasp and run to the nearest window, her arms wrapped defensively around herself. They were only kids, Megan would say. Just a pair of spotty dweebs. But Lorelei would not be assuaged. "Well, you can all go to Greece next year," she said self-righteously. "But I'm going to stay here, to protect our home." So, of course, nobody went to Greece. April, 2011. Meg's phone rang. She picked it up from the arm of Lorelei's chair, expecting it to be Bill telling her that he and the boys had checked in, that everything was going to plan. But it was an unknown number. She stared at it for a moment.
"Who is it?" asked Molly, anxiously nibbling a fingernail.
"Don't put your fingers in your mouth," hissed Meg. "Seriously, you have no idea what you've been touching." Molly let her finger drop from her mouth and wiped it absent-mindedly against the denim of her hot pants.
"Who is it?" she asked again.
Meg pressed decline. "Unknown," she said. "I'm not sure I can face talking to a normal human being right now. Maybe they'll leave a voicemail."
"You look weird sitting there," said Molly.
"I feel weird sitting here."
"Can I have a go?"
"Sure."
Meg stood up and eased herself into a corner to let Molly sit down. Molly leaned her head gingerly against the back of the armchair and rested her delicate hands upon the arms. She looked up at her mum.
So this was like where she spent all her time? Just here, in this chair?
Pretty much. According to the social worker, she went into the village a couple of times a week, had something to eat, chatted to the neighbours, went to the charity shop, bought a paper or two. Sometimes she went for a swim at the pool in town, mainly so she could have a shower, I suppose. And every weekend she'd get in the car and go to the cash and carry to pick up some bits. She groaned under her breath. Pick up some bits. Infuriating, ridiculous woman. And then she'd get home, push her way through meters of pitch-black corridors and emerge up here, like a rat out of a drain cover. Oh, don't talk about rats. And God knows what she did then. Meg looked about her for any evidence of activities. She saw her mother's laptop. It was tiny. State of the art. Must have cost a fortune. She had no idea where it had come from. She knew that her mother, despite her twin loves of the internet and shopping, had never developed an internet shopping habit, mainly because it would have taken her too long to get to the front door to collect any packages. So she must have bought this in a shop. She could not picture her mother in a shop, buying a laptop. But still, there it sat, covered in a thin layer of dust, untouched for the 4 days since Lorelei's death. There'd been talk of an online lover, a man in Gateshead called Jim, whom she'd never actually met, but with whom she'd declared dramatically she was crazy in love. It sounded, from what Meg had managed to glean from between her mother's very skewed conversational lines, as though Jim might have issues of his own. She wondered if Jim knew about Lorelei's death. And then she realised that, of course, he didn't. He probably thought he'd been dumped. Dumped by Lorelei from the Cotswolds, without so much as a by your leave. Poor Jim. Her phone rang again. Still unknown. This time she pressed answer. Hello?
Meg?
Meg's flesh wriggled slightly at the familiar tone of the caller's voice. Yes, speaking.
It's me. Beth.
Meg breathed once down the line, and then twice.
Hello?
Meg hung up. March 1991. Megan and Beth sat side by side in a subterranean concrete room off Shaftesbury Avenue. The room was a bar called Freud's. Someone had told Megan that it was the place to be, and it was certainly unlike anywhere she'd been before. Industrial was the word. Unfinished walls, beaten copper bar, cubist seating, chalked lists on blackboards, everything very dark and very uncomfortable. It was hard to concentrate on her sister sitting hunched up beside her, sipping a lemonade through a black straw, because there was a constant, overwhelming sense that something terribly exciting was about to happen over her shoulder. It wasn't, of course. Everyone else here was just like her. 20-something, office worker, new in town, earning peanuts, looking for love, expecting everything to be a lot more exciting than it actually was. Megan felt proud to sit here with Beth. Her little sister was a full 2 inches taller than her and, she imagined, a full double take more beautiful. Not that Megan was plain. Megan was far from plain. But Bethan was the one with the long mane of sleek black hair and the kissable mouth and the blushing cheeks and the legs that spoke their own language. And the boobs. Bethan was the one with the boobs. Someone once said to Megan that sisters always feel more beautiful when they're together, and ever since, Megan had found it to be true. Without Beth, Meg felt reasonable. With her, she felt exceptional. Beth was dressed in black. Black jeans, black angora cardigan with the sleeves pushed up her arms, black lace vest,
black ribbon in her black hair. "Remember your polka dot raincoat?" said Megan, returning to the place they always came back to eventually, their shared childhood.
"The pink one? How could I forget? It was literally the most important thing in the world to me. She still got it, you know."
Meg groaned and said, "Of course she has. I think that could probably apply to any random item of clothing you care to mention."
"So," said her sister, her expression growing serious, "are you coming?"
Meg groaned. Easter weekend. She'd told her mother she'd let her know, that she wasn't sure what her plans were yet, and her mother had tried to sound as though she didn't mind either way. Even though it would be the first Easter Megan hadn't spent at home, and therefore something that Lorelei would find traumatic even to contemplate. "I don't know," she said. "It's such a long way."
"I know," said Beth. "But please come. It'll be shit if you're not there."
"No, it won't," scoffed Meg. "It'll just be exactly the same as it is every single year, except with one less person around the table."
"Yes, exactly. And you're the only normal person in the family."
"Dad?"
"Well, yeah, just about. Although I think that 25 years living with Mum are finally starting to grind him down."
"He doesn't seem quite himself lately."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know. He just seems distracted. And thin. He looks very thin."
Megan considered her father. All 6 foot 1 of him, his floppy hair, his pixie face, his almost absurd patience with his highly strung, immature wife. He could not afford to be distracted or thin. He needed to be solid and sensible and fully engaged, or the whole structure of things would just come apart.
"How are the twins?"
"Hmm.
Hmm?
Oh, they're fine. But Rory's got some rather dodgy new friends."
"Hasn't he always had dodgy friends?"
"Well, yes, but these are slightly dodgier than the last lot."
"Drugs?"
Beth shrugged.
"Probably."
"Oh, God."
Megan dragged her hands through her brown curls.
"And what about Reese?"
"Reese is Reese. No dodgy friends."
"No friends at all, from what I can see.
Just sits in his room listening to grunge music, very loud, until really late.
That boy does not get enough sleep."
"No, I know. It's affecting his schoolwork. You know, Rory can just flip through his revision in half an hour and he's done, but Reese needs to really concentrate. And because he doesn't really sleep, well, Dad thinks he's going to fail all his GCSEs. And he's just a bit, you know, weird."
"What, weirder than usual, you mean?"
"Yeah, a little bit. He got hauled in front of the head teacher at school the other day for hanging around the girls' changing room."
"No."
"Yeah. It was horrible. We only found out about it because Dad knows the geography teacher and it was all round the school. And they couldn't prove he'd done it, so he wasn't punished, but now apparently all the girls hate him and they call him a creep and a pervert."
She shuddered lightly.
"It's horrible," she said, almost silently.
"Christ," said Meg.
"What does Mum say?"
"Ah, well, you know, she's taken his side, obviously. Closed ranks completely, her precious baby, etc., etc. And as she says, there is no proof. Just one girl's word against his. But to be absolutely honest," she paused and lowered her voice, "it really wouldn't surprise me if it was true. He's the oddest boy I know."
"Come down and live with me," said Megan, suddenly fearful for her soft-hearted younger sister who had barely spent a night away from home since the day she was born, and who tiptoed around the characters in her house as if they were the leading men and women and she was just a lowly extra. "Come and live in London. Seriously. There's space for another bed in my room. We could split the bills and everything. I could ask around for you for a job at my place. They've always got vacancies."
Beth smiled.
"Yeah," she said. "Right.
What?
Can you imagine me telling Mum that?
Why not?
Because... Her sister looked flustered for a second.
I don't know, she said.
She smiled.
Maybe I could.
Of course you could. You finish college in June, you'll be a qualified secretary. London will be your oyster.
Beth's face went from uncertain to quietly excited.
Yes, she said. I mean, it would be fun, wouldn't it?
Megan nodded.
10 different types of fun.
And Mum would still have the twins. Stop worrying about Mum.
I know, you're right. I just can't help it sometimes.
You need this, said Meg. You need to get away from her. From all of it. It'll swallow you whole otherwise. I mean it. It really will. And you won't even realise it's happening until it's too late.
2 days later, Beth returned home from London. The birdhouse sat quiet and dusty, filled with sunlight and distant sounds. She rested her weekend case at the foot of the stairs and called out once or twice. No one replied, and she presumed herself alone. She felt coated with the grime of the big city. Although she'd had a shower in Megan's immaculate little ensuite shower room just that morning, she couldn't shake the feeling of it all over her skin. She made herself a mug of tea and took it up to her room. She stood for a while in the middle, imagining herself not in it any more, imagining herself instead in her sister's room in Wood Green, with its high ceilings and its views over a parade of shops, its shared kitchen and flatmates from foreign countries. It didn't seem possible, although in every practical way, of course, it was. She went to her window and took in the view across the rambling gardens, down to the old green hammock at the far end and the fields beyond. Memories fluttered about her mind, of days that had passed and died and were never to return. But when she turned her thoughts to the future, there was nothing there, just space. She sighed and sat on the window ledge, pondering her lack of ambition, of forward propulsion. She'd only signed up for the secretarial course because the college was 10 minutes away and she knew she wouldn't muck it up. She assumed that at some point soon she would probably end up being a secretary, but through fatalism rather than design. She began to take off her clothes, feeling the sweet release of her breasts from the ill-fitting bra she'd been wearing since Friday morning. She looked at her body in the foxed mirror inside her wardrobe. She saw the loveliness of it, and blanched slightly, thinking of the things she hadn't told Meg in the bar that night. The looks from her brother. The sense of someone outside the bathroom door. She'd watched Rory become interested in women, but with him, it had been like the unfurling of a bud. Something natural, inevitable, almost adorable. Something separate. Entirely unconnected to her. But with Rhys, it was like a dark shadow spilling over everything he touched, including her. She wrapped her body in a towel, tucked her hair inside a shower cap, and made towards the bathroom. A strange sound made her stop outside the door of her parents' bedroom. Mum? She clutched her towel closer to her chest and gently pushed at the door. Rhys was lying in his parents' bed, the satin eiderdown pulled up to his armpits, naked as far as Beth could tell, staring straight at her.
"Jesus!" he said, surprised to see her. "When did you get home?"
She held the door half against herself, shielding her body from his strange, angry gaze.
"About 10 minutes ago," she said. "What are you doing, Rhys?"
He shrugged.
"Sleeping."
"But why are you sleeping in Mum and Dad's bed?"
"Electric blanket."
She nodded once, but then grimaced at him.
"It's 16 degrees out there. What do you need an electric blanket for?"
He shrugged.
I like it.
She nodded again.
Why are you naked?
I'm not,
he said, flipping back the eiderdown to reveal his pale body in underpants that were too large for him. She turned away and grimaced.
Fine, she said. I'm going to have a shower.
How was London? He asked before she could go.
It was good.
He nodded. She moved her gaze away from his body again and said,
Anyway,
how was Meg?
Fine, she said. She's fine.
She wanted to go now. She did not want to have a conversation with her brother lying there in his parents' bed in his underpants. She locked the bathroom door behind her and leaned against it for a moment, listening to his footsteps passing down the corridor towards the bathroom. They slowed down outside the door, and she heard his breath. And then she heard him turn and leave, and the gentle click of his bedroom door closing behind him. Meg did come home for Easter. She slept on a mattress on Beth's floor, because her own bedroom, since her last visit, had been rendered virtually uninhabitable by yet more towers of paperbacks and boxes of household goods bought in bulk from a cash and carry that Lorelei had recently signed up to.
"It's not that bad," said Lorelei, peering around the door over Meg's shoulder. "Plenty of room for you."
"Not that bad," repeated Meg.
"Jesus! Mother, why are you stockpiling?"
She brought her gaze down to the box nearest her feet.
"Insect repellent."
Her mother rolled her eyes.
"We live in the countryside," she said pointedly, as though Megan were no longer a member of this exclusive country-dwelling club. "We get a lot of insects. I mean, this is a fire hazard, isn't it? Can you imagine that lot going up? It would blow the roof off the house."
"Jesus!"
"It's economics, darling,"
her mother replied, all sing-song disingenuousness.
"Saving the family money." "Well, yes, but the family won't actually need money if we all burn to death in a massive fireball." "I get through a lot of it," her mother snapped, "and there won't be any fire. Mum, this whole house is a fire hazard. It's 50% paper."
Her mother tutted.
"You know," she said, "it's quite interesting to me that I'm perfectly happy living in this house until you come home and start criticising everything."
"That's because I'm objective, Mother. I see things that you lot don't. I see what you're doing here."
"And what exactly am I doing here, Megan, apart from looking after everybody and doing the best job I possibly can to look after our lovely house?"
Megan didn't bother to reply. It would have been too cruel. Bob and Jenny had moved out the previous summer, and the house next door was now inhabited by a young couple with a baby, who'd swapped a flat in Clapham for the picture postcard Cotswolds Cottage. They were called Vicky and Tim, and their baby was called Madeline. And of course Lorelei had invited them over for Easter lunch. Megan could only imagine that the invitation had taken them unawares, leaving them no time to form a polite excuse. She could see it with her mind's eye. Vicky stuttering and clutching her throat and saying,
"Well, yes, that would be lovely,"
with a terrible fake smile and a gulp. The baby was only 6 months old, but still Lorelei planted her foil-wrapped eggs and brought out the battered wicker baskets, and they all followed Vicky and Tim and the baby round the garden, trilling and ooing every time somebody found one, the baby in her mother's arms looking entirely nonplussed. The lamb was cooked and carved, the eggs were eaten, the foils were smoothed out, commented upon and put aside, the sun shone, there were too many carrots, not enough potatoes, the yellow walls ached under the weight of children's art, the conversation sagged under the strain of nobody really knowing what to say anymore, and Megan wished she'd stayed in London. At 4 o'clock, Vicky and Tim took their sleeping baby back home to bed, and then, rather surprisingly, Vicky reappeared 5 minutes later with a bottle of Beaujolais, and she and Lorelei secreted themselves away in the snug, where they sat and drank and laughed and talked for a full 3 hours. Meg and Beth raised their eyebrows at each other as the sound of raucous laughter drifted from the window into the garden where they sat together in the last rays of the evening sun.
"Well," said Beth, "not everybody thinks Mum's as awful as you do, you know."
"I don't think she's awful. I just think she's ill," Beth tutted.
"She's eccentric, that's all."
"Hmm.
Well, she is," laughed Beth. "Honestly, she's a sweetheart. So much energy. So much character."
"She means well."
"She does not mean well. You know, she hasn't asked me one single question about my job since I got back. Hasn't even noticed my haircut."
"Maybe she's cross with you for leaving home."
"Well, that's not normal, is it? What sort of mother gets cross with a 20-year-old for leaving home?"
"Okay, maybe not leaving home as such, but living in London."
"What's London got to do with it? Half the teenagers in this village end up living in London. It's what normal people do."
"And what about Reese?"
"What about Reese?"
"Well, she just seems to have given up on him. She didn't even make him come down for lunch. It's like she doesn't care."
"She did try. I heard her. He just refused to come down."
"Well, if that was my child, I would not be able to sit at that table with those virtual strangers going, tra-la-la-la-la-la, egg hunt, like there was nothing wrong. I would have dragged him down. I mean, he hasn't even eaten anything. And it's..." She glanced at her watch. "It's nearly 7 o'clock. It's nearly 7 o'clock, and she's sitting in there getting pissed with some woman she barely knows, and her son has been on his own all day, and she hasn't even been to check on him." She got crossly to her feet and headed indoors. "I'm going to make him a sandwich," she said. She piled offcuts of cold lamb and mint sauce between two fat slices of bloomer and smothered it with Hellmann's, then found a bag of crisps and a can of Coke and grouped them all together on a tray. She felt furious to be mothering her little brother while his real mother sat drinking red wine, delighting in the attention of a new and unsuspecting admirer. As she made her way through the house, she cringed at the cardboard boxes that lined each and every part of the staircase and hallway, the piles of unopened post, the paintings waiting to be hung, and the unwashed laundry. Everything was halfway to being where it needed to be. Everything was a work in progress, with no systems, no logic, no sense of organisation about any of it. Everyone who came here, including Tim and Vicky, gushed and cooed about the charm of the place. "It's so cosy, so welcoming." But they did not see the truth. That this house was the work of a disordered mind, and all the enablers she lived with. Megan paused for a moment on the landing and watched the birds in the trees outside. A cluster of tits and sparrows all jostling about for space. She put the tray down on the window ledge and sat. From below, she could hear her mother and her new friend squawking and shrieking, and from above, she could hear Alice in Chains blasting from her brother's room in the eaves. But outside, there were only the sounds of nature. The trilling of the tiny birds, the rumble of a distant tractor heading back after a day in the fields, a dog barking somewhere out of sight. She inhaled deeply, holding it in. She missed this when she was in London. Not this mad, claustrophobic house and its piles of stuff. Not her crazy mother or her passive father, her troubled brothers and her too nice sister. But this. The peace and the purity of life outside these windows. She breathed it in again and held it inside her for a beat. Then she picked up the tray and carried it up the 8 steps that took her to the door of her baby brother's bedroom. 8 small steps between now and then. Between what she knew and what she'd grow to wish she'd never known. Between the past and the future, between a small moment of peacefulness and the worst moment of her life. When her brother didn't open the door on the 4th knock, Megan felt a tightness in her gut, an overwhelming wave of foreboding. She put the tray down on the floor and kicked the door in. It gave way relatively easily under her amateur karate kick, just a badly screwed-in bolt, fixed by Reese himself because Lorelei didn't believe in children having locks on their rooms, on the back of the door. The music was so loud that Megan could feel it through her feet, through the ancient, buckled floorboards hammered in place 300 years ago by craftsmen who would not know what to make of this cacophony, who would imagine it to be some business of the devil. And there he was. Her baby brother. The one she'd never felt fitted in. The one she resented and failed to bond with. The small one. The worrisome one. The one she couldn't talk to. There he was, hanging by his thin, pale neck from the beams high above his single bed. Long dead by the look of him. His protruded tongue swollen and obscene. The crotch of his jeans stained wet. His eyes wide open. Chapter 3. Wednesday, 24th of November, 2010.
Hi, Jim. Can you believe this weather? They put out flood alerts in some parts of the country. What's it like in Gateshead?
I always check the forecast now for you when I listen to the weather. Looks like you're ankle deep too.
Yuck.
Luckily, we're not in a vulnerable area and there's never, fingers crossed, been flooding here. My God. Just the thought of this house going under with all my things in it. Oh, I have an awful lot of newspapers. Oh, dear, does that make me sound like a mad old hag? And they would swell up, wouldn't they? Like a cork. Plug me in here. Oh, anyway, not worth thinking about, I suppose.
I was so sorry to hear about your son. Bloody, bloody hell, Jim. So awful, even if he had been a drug addict for all those years. 31 is absolutely far too young, and the old cliche about parents outliving their children is one of the truest. It subverts the order of everything, and nothing ever makes sense again, does it? And you see, I should know. Because since we're becoming so intimate so quickly, I feel able to tell you this now. But I have lost a son too. My baby one. Little Reese. He died just after his 16th birthday. He hanged himself in his own bedroom on Easter Sunday. Sorry. I had to take a break there. You know, I've never really spoken about it to anyone. But then I never met anyone who'd lost a son too. Apart from my husband, of course, but that's different, isn't it? I did such a good job of dealing with it at the time that I was always too utterly terrified to pick at the scab, as it were. Do you understand what I mean? I don't really expect you to. I suspect you were more normal about it all. Thrashed about and screamed and wailed, etc. Anyway, so, yes, there you are. We have even more in common than we first thought. And in case you're wondering, no, Reese left no note, no explanation. It's an infinite mystery. Terrible mystery. Although, well, I've never told anyone this before, Jim, but I think I know why he killed himself. And I've never told anyone because he would have hated anyone to know. And so would I. But anyway, can't go spouting all my deepest secrets too soon. You'll run screaming for the hills. So, on to less grisly things. Are you interested at all in horoscopes? In case you are, I'm a Cancerian. I would say I'm very typical. Home-loving, nurturing, sensitive, creative, etc., etc. How about you, Jim? What star sign are you? I'm guessing at Virgo. Am I right? All the very best. Lorelei. Kiss, kiss. April 2011.
So did Grandma, like, sleep here too, said Molly, stroking the lumpy arms of the chair. Meg glanced around the room. Lorelei's bed was entirely buried beneath a landfill of clothes and bags. There was a duvet on the floor at the foot of the chair, patterned with fuchsia and lavender stripes, and a matching pillow.
I suppose she must have, she replied.
God!
Meg nodded. If there was one luxury that Meg never took for granted, it was the sensation of lying herself down at the end of every day upon a king-sized mattress, stretching out her limbs, stroking the soles of her feet against the silky bedsheets, laundered, pressed, sprayed with expensive scented water, changed every 5 days and not a moment longer, kissing her pillow, submitting to it all. When she saw homeless people, it was that, more than the constant threat of violence that they lived with, the poverty and the loneliness, that made her heart bleed for them. No bed. And here had been her own mother, in a 5-bedroom house, curling herself up every night, small and tight, her back a crooked arch, her neck a cricked right angle, in this shabby, lumpy chair, the same chair she'd sat in all day, never lying flat, never stretching out. My God, she thought, did she really hate herself that much? Come on, she said. Let's go and see what else has been going on up here. She put out a hand to help Molly out of the sagging pit of the armchair.
Can we see your room?
Meg grunted. There hadn't been a your room since roughly a week after she'd left home at the age of 20. Her mother had turned it over to junk storage even before Meg's first visit home. For what it's worth, she replied. Meg turned left out of Lorelei's room and forced her way through another junk-filled corridor to the door of her former bedroom. She pushed at it and then turned to Molly and grimaced.
Jesus Christ, she said. I think this one might actually be totally blocked up. Let me try.
Molly pressed her slight body to the door. She pushed against it with her back, with each side, and then with her arms. She turned to Meg.
It's blocked, she said. How is that even possible? I mean, how did she get that stuff in when you can't even open the door?
Meg shrugged. None of this really stands up to any kind of right-thinking analysis. None of it. Your grandma was a very strange woman.
Which one was Beth's room?
Round here, said Meg. Round this corner. She felt her way with her hands, trailing her fingertips against the damp wallpaper. Laura Ashley's finest pale green leaves against a magnolia background, still bearing the marks of the childhoods lived here. Felt-tip trails, half-ripped stickers. And there, Beth's door. Still with its plastic plaque bought from a gift shop in Weston-super-Mare. Beth's room. They'd each had one. Both the girls. Meg still remembered the excitement as they spun the carousel around and found that, yes, there was a Megan. Although no Rory and no Reese, but the twins had been too small to feel hard done by. They'd stuck them to their doors with sticky felt pads. Meg had eventually taken hers off at some point during her teenage years, and it had broken apart in her hands. She tipped it into a bin. Never thought of it again. Until now. A sudden, searing reminder that they'd once been happy. All of them. Even Reese. Impossible, she thought. Impossible. Beth had never taken her plaque down, stuck in the past as she'd been for so long, half-formed and amorphous, like an embryo in a jar. The door was half open, and peering through the gap, Meg saw, without much surprise, more generic, formless piles. The curtains across the window were drawn and dirty, drooping from the runner at one side.